nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So the last few lectures, we have been talking about this principle of band structure, which, as I've explained, that the basic objective is to find the density of states. You start from Schrodinger equation, choose a set of basis functions, turns it into a matrix equation. And in general, the size of that matrix involved here is NB times NB, where B is the number of basis functions per unit cell, and N is the number of unit cells in your solid. And usually this N is a huge number. We are talking of big solids with, you know, lots of unit cells in them. And so this is a very large matrix. In principle, you could go to a computer, but if you are dealing with periodic solids, then you can make use of that to write down all the eigenvalues in a much simpler way without actually going to a computer. And the idea, and that was the, that's the basic principle of band structure that we have been talking about, namely that this you could write in a form like this, where you have, I think the example we went through last day was an example where you had a unit cell composed of two atoms and many of them arranged in a row like this. And so when you write phi n as a column vector, what it means is the phi 1a and 1b. So let's say 1, 2, 3. This is the number of the unit cell. Unit cell number 1, unit cell number 2, unit cell number 3. And every unit cell has an a component and a b component. So here then you'd say, you've got two basis functions per unit cell. So the example I took, B was equal to 2. In general, it could be much bigger, of course. It could be 4, 10, 20, depending on the problem at hand in real things. Okay. Now, so when you write this equation in this form, E phi n equals h n m phi m, the point is these indices, n's and m's, they run over all the unit cell. And within each unit cell, of course, the phi has, like when I say phi 1, I really mean a column vector that looks like phi 1a and phi 1b. So that's what you kind of lump together and call phi 1 when you write it this way. And similarly, the matrix that connects this to that, that's really a 2 by 2 because it will have an AB component and an AB component to it. Okay, now, once you write it this way, the point is there is this periodicity which makes every unit cell identical. You stand on any unit cell, the surroundings look the same. And that allows you actually to write the solution in this form. Phi n equals phi 0 times that. And when you substitute it in there, you get another matrix equation where this matrix is given by that summation here. And you'll notice this involves a k. So if I put in a particular value of k, I'll get a different matrix. So the important point is that, you see, we started with a matrix equation that the matrix was NB by NB. We end up with another matrix equation. And you might say, what have we gained? Well, the thing is, this is a whole lot smaller. What's the size of this matrix? B by B. Here we are talking B by B. Okay? So instead of diagonalizing a matrix that's NB by NB, instead of finding the eigenvalues of a matrix that's big, you're actually finding the eigenvalues of a matrix that's only B by B. But you have to do it n times, in principle. Why n times? Well, because there are n allowed values of k within the Brevand zone. And for, in principle, for every k, it's a different matrix. But the thing is, it's much easier to diagonalize a 2x2 matrix 100 times. In other words, to diagonalize 100 2x2 matrices than to be finding the eigenvalues of a 200x200 matrix at the same time. So anyway, so that's this principle of band structure, which allows you to go from this NB by NB down to a B by B. And then if you had only one basis function per unit cell, then of course B by B really just means 1x1. That's just an algebraic equation then, right? You had a question? Yes.
From a formational point of view, these two matrices are the same?
The eigenvalues are the same. The eigenvectors should be the same. So this is all exact. In the sense, if you had never heard of the principle of band structure and found the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of that matrix directly, you'd get the same answer as we'll get from here. So it's an exact thing, which is why, so in your homework problems, I usually kind of try to give a few examples to show you very small problems where you can do it both ways. And the whole purpose is to convince yourself that the principle really works. See? That's it. But it's, right. No approximations. This is an exact thing. The main important point is the periodicity. Because if you didn't have that, it wouldn't work. Because what this tells you is, when I find h of k, I'm supposed to find this summation. Okay, sum over m. That means m, of course, runs over all the unit cells. But what about n? N is a specific unit cell. So you stand at one unit cell and do the summation. Now, if you didn't have periodicity, then what you get will depend on where you stand.
So you need the whole matrix.
In that case, right. In that case, this won't be a unique matrix at all. What allows you to apply this principle is the fact that this sum is independent of where we stand. So in this thing, you could be standing here, whatever you see around you, you go someplace here, exactly the same. You do your, put your n anywhere you want, do the summation about all m, and the answer should be the same. It doesn't matter where you stand. Okay, so last day I think we went through this example, this linear one. Today what I want to do is, again, apply this principle. So if I had to summarize the principle of band structure, this is it. This is the D1 equation that you should remember. And everything else we talked about was kind of special cases of that. And rather than do this general thing right away, we went through a few special examples to get here. But everything else is a subset of this. If you understood this, it all follows from here, really. Okay? Now, what we'll do today is apply this to a problem that's currently of great interest, actually. As I say, these days, you know, people are studying all kinds of materials and structures for devices. And one of the common ones you'll see a lot of, or hear a lot of these days, is something called graphene. So what we'll do is, I'll apply this principle to calculate this band structure of graphene. Okay? And it's actually, regardless of this interest in this material, it's also a very nice example to go through, in the sense that it's a two-dimensional, what graphene is actually a two-dimensional sheet. That is, graphite, as you know, is a very common form of carbon. I mean, diamond is one form, that's all carbon, and graphite is another common form of carbon. And graphite is very different from diamond. And graphite is composed of layers of carbon, layers that are kind of weakly interacting, so that, which is why it kind of wants to slide off layer by layer. And the way people make these graphene sheets is actually kind of by picking off a layer. And often the method they use is something, I mean, which sounds very simple in principle, though I'm sure it's not as easy to really implement it. And that is, put down a scotch tape and peel it off. And it kind of comes off with a layer, essentially. Okay. Now, that layer of carbon, that's what's usually what people called graphene. Okay. And what makes it kind of nice example to go through on a blackboard is the fact that it's two-dimensional. So that makes the details a little simpler than what you'd have in, say, a solid like silicon or diamond, where the issues are three-dimensional and much harder to visualize. On the other hand, it's not quite as simple as this. So it brings out a lot of the non-trivial aspects of band structure that you have to deal with. So in other words, it's got enough complexity to be interesting, I mean, more than that. And it's, of course, as I said, a very important practical problem these days. It's one on which people are writing research papers. It's kind of, in that sense, right at the frontiers of research. And at the same time, it's simple enough, I can actually do it on a blackboard. You see? And there's usually not too many examples like that. So now, the way carbon looks, this graphene structure looks like, is something like this. It's carbon atoms arranged in a hexagonal pattern. So there's a carbon atom at each of these vertices, so like this. Etc. Now, so first question is, if I were to write down this H matrix, how big is this B, number of basis functions per unit cell? That's the first issue. How many basis functions? Well, as you know, carbon has an atomic number of 6. So the way it looks is, the 1s level has 2 electrons, and then you have this 2s and 2p levels. So 2px, 2py, and 2pz. There's 4 of them. So, but this atomic number is 6, so 2's gone there, and so there's basically 4 electrons around here. So total of 4 electrons, so usually people put 2, something like this. So and these 2's are, of course, distributed amongst all this, okay. These 4. Okay, so these would be what you'd call the valence shell. So usually, as you know, when you take the, if you're trying to describe the valence electrons, then the basis functions you use are these, the valence function, the wave functions of the atomic orbitals, except that you just use the outer one. You usually don't worry about the core one, because that is way down in energy. It usually doesn't mix with the valence electrons. So you can get a fairly good description by using these. So if you went with that, you'd have about 4 basis functions per unit cell, okay? Or rather 4 basis functions per atom. What needs a little more discussion, and that we'll do next, is how many atoms per unit cell? Okay? That we'll get to, because you see, when you had a linear lattice, it was clear that the unit cell was just one atom. On the other hand, if you had 2 of them together like this, then again, common sense tells you that the unit cell is 2 of them. That's easy enough to see. Here, it's not quite so obvious whether the unit, what is the unit cell. So it needs a little more discussion. That we'll talk about. But the other important point that kind of makes this graphene problem relatively easy to do is that if we take this as the XY plane, so let's call this X and Y, just the XY plane, then what happens is, when you look at the actual eigenstates, there is one group of eigenstates that are composed of these, that are described by linear combinations of these orbitals, S, PX, PY, and then there is a separate group that's composed of the PZ, and the two are completely disjoint. So what that means is, if I were writing down this Hamiltonian matrix, there are no off-diagonal elements that couple this group to that group. So those are kind of two disjoint groups in that whole matrix. So what that means is you can talk about this and this separately. That's approximately true, but it's a very good approximation. In fact, as long as this whole thing is completely flat, I believe that's an exact statement, actually. That this doesn't get mixed into this. Number one. Now, number two, and this needs a little more discussion, which we'll get to probably at the end of today's lecture or tomorrow, the next lecture, is that if you're interested in the valence electrons, remember, usually what you're interested in is, if your chemical potential is around here, you're only interested in the states right around there. You don't care too much about things that are 5 volts away, let's say. And the thing is that in graphene, these the electronic states around the chemical potential are all composed of orbitals of this type. Whereas these types, the part that involves these things are far away from the chemical potential. That's not an obvious statement. I'll try to explain this a little better later. But at this time, the main point is that when I'm trying to describe the valence electrons of graphene, I can use just this as my basis function. I don't actually need to take all 4. If I use just this, I'll get a good enough description. Yes.
As far as I remember from my high school chemistry, organic chemistry, similar structure like benzene used to reside most of the time in two what we call as the armchair structures, which were not planar. Since the hybridization of this is also sp2, and that was and benzene also hybridized into sp2 orbitals. So shouldn't this also be residing mostly in like armchair structure? And
so what? Will it be planar? So the point you are saying is that whether this will want to be planar or would kind of bend up or down a little bit, where this will kind of get pushed up a little and something gets pushed down, right? Now, possibly in real structures, you know, people do worry about these issues. And a lot depends on what substrate you put it in, what the environment is. Because usually in chemistry, you're talking about molecules in solution. It's usually wet chemistry. Whereas here, we are really talking of something that's sitting on a dry substrate, and the issues are different. But it's true that people do worry about whether it is really absolutely flat or not. So that statement I made, that this group is decoupled from that, that's an exact statement if it's completely flat. If it's not completely flat, then it's not an exact statement anymore. But I think for all practical purposes, it still works reasonably well. But a second-order issue that, again, people write papers on and worry about is that, well, if it's curved a little bit, what it will do to the density of states? How will it affect things? That's an issue that people worry about and talk about. Okay.
Yeah. The fact that we have a division into two disjoint sets, has it to do with the theory of angular momenta and the angular momentum in z direction that cannot commute with the others?
Yeah, though I think in essence it is much simpler. Namely, it is just that, it is this thing that we had discussed, that any matrix element involved looks something like this, dr u of one of those, let's say the s, and u of, say, pz, and some h in between. So whenever you are trying to actually calculate off-diagonal matrix element, you have to do an integral of this type. And this function is anti-symmetric in Z. This function is symmetric. And as long as there is nothing in your Hamiltonian that is this anti-symmetric character to it, these integrals will turn out to be zero. So in essence, it is really something like that. Right. So, and that is why this thing being planar is very important. That is absolutely in
the
swipe line.
The same discussion, right?
Right. It's not, those issues usually are most useful when talking about atomic states, because there you have the spherical symmetry, and thinking in terms of angular momentum wave functions is very useful. Okay. That's it. Okay. So, anyway, so in this context, then, for the moment, the main point I wanted to make is, you only need one basis function per atom. And that really makes it simple, because otherwise we'd be dealing with a 4x4 matrix right away, because you'd have all 4 basis functions per unit cell. You see, that's the thing. So your B would have been 4, but I don't really need this. And this is a core one. I don't need that either. So I just need a 2PZ. So the way people do the simplest theory of graphene is that there is a PZ orbital per atom, and the wave functions we are looking for, are linear combinations of such things. Those are the basis functions. That's it. Okay. Now, that brings us to the next point, which is how many atoms per unit cell? And as I said, Here it was pretty obvious. Here it needs some discussion. Now, if you had, so let's say you think of this as your unit cell. Now, point is that that would be acceptable if you can define two vectors, say A1 and A2, and you are able to write the position of every other atom as a combination of some integer times this plus some integer times that. If you could do that, then I believe you can show that, that you could view this as a unit cell, you know, which you could just move by, you know, say 2 units of this and 5 units of that and create another unit cell. If you can create your entire lattice by moving it by various integer numbers of those, then that would be a valid unit cell. So, for example, if you had a square lattice, then the unit cell is clear. It's this. Anywhere else you want to go, let's say you want to go here. Well, that's 2 units move this way, 1 unit move that way. You want to go here. Okay, 1 unit this way, 1 unit that way. So then, you know, that's like a valid unit cell. Now, here the problem is that from here, if I want to, let's say, go to this point, okay, I move 1 unit of that. That's good. That's okay. Now, you want to go there, I can take 1 unit of that. Now, the thing is that out of linear combinations of these, I can't do the rest. You see, these are two-dimensional things, so I have these 2 vectors I'm allowed, A1 and A2. That's fine. But after that, I'm in trouble, because when I want to do this one, I cannot say, well, it's 1 unit of this and 1 unit of that. That won't take me there. See, it doesn't quite work. Now, what I want to show you is it works quite well, though, if we assume 2 of these as our unit cell. So then what I can show you is, you know, think of these like this. So 2 of them, they come together. So what I claim now is that I can define 2 vectors. One is this one, and the other is that one. I'll call this A1, call that A2. Those are the 2 vectors. And I can take this unit cell and go to any other unit cell I want just by combining various integer numbers of this and this. So, for example, I want to go from here to there, well, it's 1 unit of that. Easy enough. Want to go from here to there, well, it's 1 unit of that. Okay. Where else would we want to go? Let's say you want to go here. Well, it's 1 unit of that plus 1 unit of that, because those 2 vectors added up will give me that vector. That's that vector is really just A1 plus A2. Anything else? You want to go here? That's just negative of A2. Want to go there? That's negative of A1. That's it. So you can show yourself. Now this works, you see? And so the unit cell then, one way to consider the unit cell is like 2 atoms. Now, you can always choose a bigger unit cell. In fact, this last homework problem that you have is designed to show you that, that take a linear lattice where unit cell only needs to contain 1 of them, but I said do it with 2 atoms as your unit cell and see that you get exactly the same answer. So you can always take a bigger unit cell in principle. It just complicates the thing unnecessarily. So what you want to use is the smallest possible unit cell. And the thing is here, 1 atom is not an acceptable unit cell. The smallest one you could get away with is 2 of them. Okay. So what is B then for our problem? So remember, number of basis functions per unit cell. So it's 2. Because we are coming to one basis function per atom, we agreed that just a PZ would be okay. And then you got 2 atoms per unit cell. So you got 2 basis functions. So for this problem, then, B is 2. So after we are all done, so what we'll be doing next is evaluating this H for different Ks. And after we're all done, we'll get a 2x2 matrix, which will give us 2 eigenvalues. That's kind of what we'll be doing after this. And last day, we did that with that linear lattice, you know, the one with 2 atoms coming together. What we're now going to do is do the same problem, but with do something similar, but a little more complicated because we're talking about this lattice. Yeah. Okay. So those 2 vectors are kind of useful, so let me write them up here for future reference, this A1 and A2. And usually, what you can easily look up anywhere, handbook, Google, whatever, is this carbon-carbon bond length. So let me call that, say, A0. I believe the number is something like 1.4 angstroms or so, 0.14 nanometers, yeah. That's about 1.4 angstroms. That's this carbon-carbon bond length in graphene. So I'll call that A0. So my first question is, what is A1 in terms of that basic unit, A0? You know, it has an X component and a Y component. So can you help me with what it is? So you're trying to write A1, that's this vector. And A0 is that much, and I'm trying to write its X component, which means I'm really trying to write that much. So how much is that? Well, you see, it's this and then that. And the thing is, this angle is 60 degrees, and cosine 60 is half. So this much is actually half A0. So the whole thing is actually 3/2 A0. And now the Y component, that's this much. That's actually A0 sine 60 degrees, because that angle is 60. And sine 60 is square root 3 over 2. So you get this square root 3 A0 over 2. That's it. Now what about A2? Same X, opposite Y, negative Y. That's it. Okay, so this just for future reference. I'm writing it down here. Okay, so the next thing I want to do is we want to form this matrix H of K. How many terms? Remember the rule is, if you do that summation, you stand at some n. So let's call this n. You stand here. And then do a sum over all m's. In principle, all m's, but then no need to include any m with which it's not directly connected. Only the directly connected ones. So how many are directly connected? 1, 2, 3, 4. And then there's always the n equals m, so 5 terms in all. So first thing we need to write down is the one that's directly connected. That's easiest. It doesn't have any phase factors. That's always the first one to write down. So let's write down this one. So what we're trying to write down then is this matrix, where it's nn, ab, ab. So it's basically as if you have 2 carbon atoms, A and B. And you're in the nth unit cell, A and B. And we're trying to write down that matrix. So what will it be? Our basic model is, again, site energy. This diagonal elements are, we'll call it, say, epsilon. And the connection to the nearest neighbor, we'll call it T. And again, as I said, in the semi-empirical method, that's all the parameters you really need, epsilon and T. And experimentally, people believe the T to be about 2.5 to 3 electron volts. I mean, then there are different experiments that try to match, and they argue whether it's 2.7 or 2.8, et cetera. but for this discussion is somewhere between 2.5 and 3. Okay. So that's a T there. That's it. No further phase factors to write. This one is easy. It's the next one. We'll take a little more discussion. So now we are standing on the nth one, and then we have to do all four. So we can start any way you like. So let's say we start with this guy. So which ones are non-zero? Again, remember our model, we only have nearest neighbor connections. So which ones are non-zero? Of those four connections? Remember, the only real connection here is this one. Okay. That's the only connection between this and this. That was just a vector I drew to define the vector. I mean, there's no bond there. There's no direct connection there. Right? That's not a nearest neighbor. So that's no connection. So, in fact, yeah, might as well take this out even from here so there's no confusion. That's not a part of the actual thing. So just to remind ourselves, I'll put an A1 here so we remember what that even is. But okay. So it's this. So only connection is between NB and this N plus 1 or whatever you call it, A. So the only connection is between this B and the next one here. So I mean, these M's, I can number these. I could call this 1, 2, 3, and 4. So N, so the connection is between NB and 1A. NB and 1A. So this is where I put the T, rest are all zeros. Yeah.
Why is on T not T prime? Because this line is not equal to the vector magnitude.
Oh, you're saying that somehow this T should be a little different from that. No, because that T comes from, if we're actually doing a real theory, you'd have taken a wave function here and a wave function here and done an integral. Right? Remember, the way the T comes about is, let's say I have a carbon here and a carbon here. One basis function looks like this around this. Another one looks like this. So if I were evaluating them honestly, I'd be doing an integral with this times this and some operator in between. And it doesn't quite matter whether the A and B look like this. In other words, this same thing, when you're talking about this bond, it's the same thing just turned around a little bit. But that doesn't make any difference to the integral. Okay? And these are not vector quantities, just a scalar integral that you're writing. So if this is 2.5 volts, this is also 2.5 volts. They're all much the same. What's the phase factor? Remember, ik dot dm minus dn. And what dm minus dn means is the vector that joins this. It's that vector, the one I wiped out. And that's what I called a1. So I should just put an e to the power ik dot a1. So we're done with 1. I could now try 2. So can you help me with the matrices? Which one's non-zero? When I look here, I think it's the same story because it's NB connected to 2A. That's the only connection. So NB connected to 2A, so I put a T there. Rest all zeros. But the phase factor is IK dot A2. Okay, next, I have to do 3 and 4, and then we'll be done. So NA, NB, 3, AB. Now the only real connection is this one. So, which is the non-zero element? Na 3b, right? So that thing. So you have a T there. So it's the transpose of that one, actually, not the same matrix. And now, of course, this vector is not plus A1, but it's actually minus A1. It's going the opposite way. And so the phase factor should be e to the power minus I k dot A1. And one more, and we are done with this. So now I have to do the N and 4. So it's this one. So the connection is between NA, 4B. Right? AB. So NA and 4B. So again, it goes to the same upper right hand. That's the connection. What's the phase factor? Right. Now when I look at the vector, remember the vector connects some point on this unit cell to a corresponding point on that unit cell. So if I connect this point to this point, I could draw it like this. If I want to connect this point to that point, I can draw it like this. But you shouldn't draw this one, for example. That's not the right vector to be using. It's any point to a corresponding point, is the way I think. Okay, that's it. So now what we can do is sum these all up and write the overall matrix, all four. And at the end of the day, it will be a 2x2 matrix, and that's what we need. So we'll write that 2x2 matrix. Okay, so what's the diagonal element? Remember, I'm just adding matrices, so diagonal element means I look at this point everywhere and add them all up. And that's easy because that's the only one that's non-zero. That's easy enough. So this is epsilon. Same with the other diagonal element. It's just epsilon. Nothing to talk about. Now let's do the 1, 2. This one. So I look here. I see a T. Nothing here, nothing here. And then there's two of them here. So basically I get T times 1 plus e to the power I k dot A1 plus e to the power I k dot A2. Think.
Minus.
Very good. Thank you. Minus. Good. And then we go to the 2, 1. So down here, I got this. This and this. Nothing else. Rest is zero. So that's the 2x2 matrix. Now, if you think of the eigenvalues of this, now, this is where, again, remember one thing I mentioned before is that anytime you have a matrix whose these two diagonal elements are equal, and then you have some complex number, and of course, these are always Hermitian. So if you have, say, H0 here, you'll end up with a H0 star there. So here also, this is complex. If I call this H0, then this is H0 star. That you can see. And the thing is, last day I think we went through an example, and you can again check to be sure you're comfortable with it. What are the eigenvalues of this? Epsilon plus or minus magnitude of H0. That's the thing. So in this case, when I actually find the eigenvalues, the way it will go is, like if I am plotting against K, there's this epsilon, and then all the eigenvalues will be symmetrically distributed around it. So it'll be epsilon plus something here, epsilon minus something here. So we'll have a whole bunch of states, a whole bunch of eigenvalues corresponding to different values k. But the thing is, it will all be symmetric. Every time you have something here, you'll have something there, actually. Okay? And if the H0 happens to be small, if the magnitude of H0 happens to be small, then you'd be right around here. And if the magnitude of H0 happens to be big, you'd be somewhere up here. That's the basic idea. Okay? Now, one thing that is very important in terms of all these eigenvalues, as I've mentioned, the part you really want to know most about is those that are right around the chemical potential. So the question that comes up is, where exactly is the chemical potential in all this? You know, we have found a whole bunch of eigenvalues. Where exactly is the chemical potential? And the thing is that in graphene, at equilibrium, a piece of graphene sitting by itself, this is actually where the chemical potential is. Now, that's not an obvious statement. I want to explain this a little. That's why I want to kind of spend the rest of the lecture actually explaining that point, right? Why it is right around here. Okay? And the way to think about it is something like this, that you see, we discussed that the unit cell is composed of these two carbon atoms, right? So that's this unit cell. And when we are constructing these basis functions, if you remember, we said that in general you could take, let me take this off for the moment. In general, you could be taking an S level and a PX level and a PY level and a PZ level here. S, PX, PY, PZ. These would be the basis functions. So if the carbon atom were by itself, those would have been, they say, the eigenvalues. The actual eigenvalues. There would be a S level and a PX. Actually, S, they won't be exactly, they won't have the same energy. As I said, in hydrogen atom, they happen to have the same energy. In anything else, usually the S is a little lower. But that's a minor issue here. With the carbon, again, you'd have a bunch of things like this. And when you bring them together, if you just thought about the two carbon atoms, when you bring them together, what happens, as we have discussed, is anytime you have two levels that have about the same energy and you bring them together, there's a bonding level and an anti-bonding level. So you think that somewhere around here there would be a set of anti-bonding levels, four of them, and a set of bonding levels, four of them, that would kind of split apart from all this, right? Yeah. Now, at equilibrium, I mean, left to itself, which ones would want to be filled? Well, the way to think about it is each carbon atom came with four electrons. I mean, atomic number is six, but then two of them are, of course, in the 1s levels. Remember that six is 1s2 and then another four in this 2s, px, py, pz. So we got about four electrons to talk about here. Now, left. This way, you got four states here and four states here. And how many electrons do we have? We've got four electrons from here and four electrons from there. Now, we've got eight electrons to accommodate. So where will the eight electrons go? 8 electrons will go into these 4 states. I mean, of course, each state holds only 1 electron, but then states always come in pairs because of up spin and down spin that we know. So each one has this. There's a corresponding down spin that goes with it. And so finally, this holds 8 electrons. And as I mentioned before, this is the essence of covalent bonding. With hydrogen bonding also, with hydrogen atoms when they form a molecule, exactly the same thing happens. Anyway, so the net result is that there is this kind of line around here, and all things are pushed down here. These are all filled. Those are all empty. Okay. Now, what we discussed, what I had said earlier, is that only the pz orbitals matter. We don't need to worry about s, px, and py. Now, why is that? Well, the thing is, you're going to argue that if you just had 2 carbon atoms, this is where the chemical potential would have been. Why? Well, you see, chemical potential is the line that divides the filled states from the empty ones. So that's where the chemical potential would have been if you just had 2 carbon atoms to talk about. Nothing more, right? Now, of course, you could have put it a little bit higher or lower, anywhere in that range, somewhere in here. But the point is it would be somewhere around here. That's what you think. Okay. Now, when you bring these together, the argument is that usually the pz orbitals are don't split up apart quite as much as the spxpys. So the spxpys are kind of way up here or way down here. And the pz's are around right here. Now, why is it that the pz orbitals are kind of closer than the other ones? Well, the argument goes that when you have a pz orbital, it's like something that's sticking out this way, and they don't overlap quite as much. And so when you actually look at that off-diagonal term t, it is a whole lot smaller than what you would have calculated for spxpy type of things, because pxpys have wave functions that go like this. And they overlap a lot more this way, whereas pz's tend to be overlap a whole lot less. So this is something that's been established by people, you know, who have actually looked at the wave functions, done those integrals, calculated it. That's an established thing. The pz's are kind of closer. Spxpy's are further away. So what that means, of course, is if your chemical potential were around here, this is what you'd worry about most. These are the levels you'd worry about. So that kind of justifies this point I had made earlier, that if you just want to talk about current flow, then you can get by with pz's. But the point I'd like to stress is that that's only true if you're talking about current flow, not if you're trying to figure out, say, what makes this structure stable, or what is the, let's say, if I want to, what would be the melting point of graphene, you know, the kinds of things that material scientists worry about. Because then what makes the bond strong, what really keeps it together, is, the, of course, this energy that it gains. So this is very important in terms of the total energy of the system, again, that if you're trying to figure out the mechanical strength of graphene, issues like that. But if you are talking current flow, then these are not, people don't worry about it. So usually the technical name is, they call these the sigma bonds and call these the pi bonds. The pi bonds, these pi orbitals, that's what is important as far as current flow goes. The sigma ones are kind of separate. Far away, you don't need to worry. Anyway, so what we just did, though, this is what, you can see it if you just had 2 carbon atoms. Now, what we have is a very big lattice of these things. Now, what we did was, when you put together a big lattice, then what happens is instead of having one level here, you have a whole bunch of levels like this. And you have a whole bunch of levels like this. And what we found was the distribution of how they are spread out. You see, that's what this epsilon plus minus H0 gives us. And the epsilon is like the central mean line. And below it, you have a whole set of states. Above it, you have a whole set of states. Right around that. But the point is, at equilibrium left to itself, it will want to be half filled. And so the way you are half filled is by having a chemical potential right in the middle. Because it's all perfectly symmetric. There's just as many states above as below. So if you need to fill them up just halfway with the electrons you have, then the place to have your chemical potential is right in the middle. So that's why what is in this case of graphene, the problem that we are doing, you have a set of states, epsilon plus minus something, and it's symmetric. If you have 20 states here, you've got 20 states there. And overall, if you want to be half-filled, that's exactly where the chemical potential will be. Now, of course, if you dope the graphene, and people do that by putting in other kinds of atoms in it, then you can shift the chemical potential up or down.
If we apply potential?
If you apply an electric field, potential, just like a gate voltage here, you can always move this up and down.
Okay.
Just as with any material, you can take the density of states and move it up or down. With graphene also, you could do the same. But the thing is, left to itself, if it was neutral, no extra electrons, no deficit of electrons, then it would want to be right in the middle. And so the density of states, later this week or next week, we'll be talking about what the density of states looks like. And what you'd find is it actually looks something like this. It goes to zero, goes up linearly one way, goes up linearly the other way, and left to itself, the chemical potential is somewhere here, as long as it's neutral. Now, if you put a voltage on this gate, you can move this up or down. And, then it could end up looking like this. You've got some extra electrons. Or you could move it up and make it look like that. That's possible, right? And that's how if you're trying to do something useful with it, you usually try to move it around. And then you can also move it around by actual chemical doping, by putting in other impurities. And those are all things that people are trying to do. These are all, at current research. These are all people writing papers on how to do these things at this time. It's not at all clear, really. Anyway, let me stop here today.